Today, July 25th, 2017. The time is 11 a.m. This is a hearing of the District of Columbia Rental Housing Commission. The location is the hearing room in Suite 1140 North, 441 4th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. We are here pursuant to D.C. Law 610. The Rental Housing Act of 1985 as amended. I'm Commissioner Michael Spencer, and I will serve to chair today's hearing. With me today on my right is Commissioner Diana Hurst-Epps. The chairman is recusing himself from any consideration of this appeal. The ground is the avoidance of any appearance of impropriety, unfairness, or bias in the Commission's determination of the outcome of this appeal. The grounds for his decision are of recent origin and did not exist at the time of his deliberations on, determinations regarding, or issuance of any of his prior orders or decisions in this case on appeal. Under the Rental Housing Act and its regulations, two commissioners constitute a quorum to do the commission's work and render decisions on appeals. So this appeal will be heard and decided by Commissioner Hurst-Epps and myself. We have one argument today, notice for hearing at 11 a.m. in regards to the housing accommodations located at 4248 4th Street Southeast, Apartment 101, 4283 6th Street Southeast, Apartments 201 and 202, 4285 6th Street Southeast, Apartment 202, 4287 6th Street Southeast, Apartment 102, 4291 6th Street Southeast, Apartment 301, and 4297 6th Street Southeast, Apartment 201. The tenant petition number is TP26197. The case is styled Cascade Park Partners, LLC, Housing Provider Appellant, versus Erna Walker et al., tenants appellees. The commission notes that there are parties seated before it and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the housing provider appellant.
I'm Roger Lux, counsel for housing provider appellant Cascade Park Partners, LLC.
Thank you, Mr. Lux. And for the tenants appellees?
John Blake and Rebecca Krassel.
Thank you. I would briefly like to explain commission procedures. The commission's rules are similar to those of the D.C. Court of Appeals. Each party will have 20 minutes to present its case, beginning with the housing provider appellant. The housing provider appellant may reserve up to 5 minutes of its 20 minutes for rebuttal following the presentation of the case of the tenant's appellees. The tenant's appellees must present all of their argument within the 20-minute time frame and will have no rebuttal time. In its discretion, the commission may allow additional time for argument to a party in the event that we engage in questions to occupy a substantial portion of its time. The Commission's hearings will be recorded on an audio CD. The Commission's decision will be issued in writing and sent to the parties within 30 to 45 days. In this proceeding, the Commission does not request, nor will it accept, post-hearing submissions from either party. Please turn off any cell phones or other electronic devices. In the interest of administrative efficiency and the opportunity for prompt resolution of this appeal. The Commission respectfully asks each party whether each party may be interested in settling this case on appeal before your arguments. We have a very experienced settlement officer who would serve as the settlement official for the parties. The Commission, like the D.C. Court of Appeals, encourages settlement of disputes on appeal. Do we think settlement is a possibility?
The housing provider does not. There have been some previous exchanges, but terms are just not agreeable, so we do not think it can be settled.
Okay. Well, being that the housing provider is not in a position to entertain settlement, we'll proceed. The Commission is not aware of any preliminary matters in this case. Does either of the parties wish to raise any matters at this time?
Not for the housing provider.
Great. Hearing none, the housing provider appellant may proceed with your case, but first, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would wish to reserve just maybe 2 minutes for rebuttal, because I probably, my rebuttal will be included in the presentation.
Okay. And with that, we'll get started.
We have gone through a number of theories in our brief on why the decision was wrong, and rather than go through them item on item because they speak for themselves, I'll just very generally describe them, and then, as I just mentioned, go to rebuttal, because the tenant's brief sort of makes itself makes rebuttal appropriate in the opening argument, because they do not challenge our legal arguments on the merits. The first is the obvious constitutional argument, and we've cited Supreme Court precedent. You can't add somebody to a case after a hearing, effectively at the point of judgment, who has never made a party, never given a chance to present their own position. And we've cited specifically the USA Nelson case on that point. It's virtually directly on point. This is even more egregious than that, I'd say. But be that as it may, that's exactly what Ms. Wiggins did in this case. It was thoroughly unconstitutional.
Counsel, can I interrupt you? I apologize. When you're looking at the acting rent administrator Wiggins' decision in this matter, she referenced that she attached both contract A and contract B, meaning the one contract presumably that represented 5%, the other contract that represented, you know, the 95%. Did you ever receive, or do you have a copy of what I'm referring to as the 5% or the?
I have seen them. I don't recall seeing them attached, but I'm agnostic on that. I can't say they were, they weren't. I've certainly seen them, in part because her clients had them after she issued her decision.
So it's not a situation that it was the order that she issued, it was actually attached. That was actually attached.
I don't recall they were attached, but I can't swear to that they weren't. But obviously the point you get to is, number one, well, as I said, I don't want to spend too much time. I can, if you wish, go through the details, but the legionary errors, and clearly intentional deprivation of rights here, are legion. She added our client without joining it as a party, without giving it prior notice. She took official or judicial notice of documents on the land records, which you are not permitted to do. We've side cases without advising the people who are parties that you intend to take official notice to give them an opportunity to respond. Now, our client wasn't a party, but perhaps Cascade, the original party, I'll say Cascade Inc., would have notified us at the time. But be that as it may, she basically took official notice of documents not presented by the tenants in evidence, not presented by anybody in evidence, as a basis to enter a judgment against our client without even telling our client that she was going to do that. They found out after the fact, of course, from counsel for Cascade Parking. So procedurally, that is patently a violation of due process. on the substantive, I raise substantive due process, and the reason for that is this. Our view is what Ms. Wiggins did was not accidental. Somehow she learned of the 95-5 agreement, which was not in this case and had nothing to do with this case, and she decided to use a term in the agreement between the parties to try to hang our party with the obligation of Cascade Inc. because Cascade Inc. had, by the time she issued her decision, sold all 100% of its interest in the building. Setting aside the procedural due process issues, substantive due process constitutes a patent abuse of substantive law. And as an attorney in her position, she must have known that a tenancy in common agreement does not create a subsequent tenant in common, does not establish liability in that later tenant in common for the wrongs of the prior tenant in common.
You're not in any way contesting the actual judgment in this instance, correct? The merits of the judgment.
As against Cascade Inc.? No, but because we can. We weren't party. We weren't involved in the hearings. Keeping in mind that the hearings concluded in 2001. The LLC was not established, this is in the record, until I think 2004, maybe 2003, before they purchased the first 95% interest.
Do you know if Cascade Inc. still exists?
Do not know. I'm glad you raised that because I'm going to get to that, a point related to that momentarily. So substantively, any attorney, apart from knowing procedurally you can't do what you do, knows that tenants in common are not jointly and severally liable for debts unless there's an agreement that says so, or there's a statute which says so.
So if we remand this back, and the issue really is, because as I'm sure you're more than well aware, it's not for us to kind of get into the four corners of any contractual issues, whether there's 95 or contract B or contract A. You know, the real issue would seems to say is that the tenants would need to essentially enforce this judgment perhaps across the way. It wouldn't be for us to, because in order to do that, you'd have to interpret any contract, right?
In theory, yes and no. I mean, here's, and I was going to get to this later, but I'll get to it now. The entire tome of the tenant's brief is, we've waited for 16 years, and somebody's got to pay us for these overcharges. They didn't deal with constitutional issues. They didn't deal with the law of tenancy in common. They didn't deal with the limitations issue. They just said Ms. Wiggins was right to do what she should have done. Now, what they could and should have done after she issued her decision
in 2008,
in 2007, I think.
Oh,
but,
okay.
But you'll recall, and they say themselves, we moved to make Cascade Inc., not our clients, but apparently the prior owner had name changes. We moved to make them the housing provider on two occasions. It wasn't ruled upon. They stated in their exceptions and objections that they wanted those motions granted, perfectly appropriate at the time. Ms. Wiggins said, I'm not going to grant it because they don't own the building anymore. Another substantive due process violation. But if I can say, what the tenants could and should have done was to appeal that ruling, have Cascade Inc., the true owner that committed the violations, named its proper party, and then they could have undertaken to try to enforce a judgment. And if Cascade Inc. did not exist anymore, the law permits your tracing the assets of a dissolved corporation to whoever those assets were distributed to. Obviously, our client paid for the property, substantial sum, 100%. Those assets went to that corporation. If Cascade Inc. was dissolved, I'm guessing it was, those assets were distributed to its shareholders. Had they gone ahead and gotten their judgment against Cascade Inc., which they could have done, they could have traced the assets of sale to the shareholders. Interestingly, they did not try to say or argue on appeal or even down below, please make both the LLC and Cascade Inc. the respondent. It would have been wrong legally to say the LLC, but they could have kept in Cascade Inc. They didn't make that choice. They said, okay, Ms. Wiggins has given us a deep pocket. We're going to pursue this to the end of the earth against that deep pocket and forget about the actual violator.
Counsel, two points. First, if we can just refer to her as Judge Wiggins, it would be better for the record.
Okay.
Secondly, is this not an issue of successor liability?
It is not, because the case law that I've cited says tenants in common, one tenant in common is not a successor of another. There's no privity, and I've included D.C. Court of Appeals case law. There is no privity between tenants in common, period. A successor liability would occur, have occurred, if the LLC had purchased all the shares of Cascade Inc., or if it were an alter ego of Cascade Inc.
But again, kind of getting back to what I initially brought up, the conversation, even the conversation that you just described as to Cascade Inc. purchasing all of the shares, I mean, this really gets into the conversation about contract A, contract B, and then eventually a year later spring into a third contract, which again, the interpretation of contracts and the ultimate result of those contracts are not things specifically appropriate for us to decide. Again, would that not be across the street, the issues of interpreting contracts?
And that is a point that I made because of the third-party beneficiary theory. Now, the tenants have said in their brief they agree they're not third-party beneficiaries, but that's what Judge Wiggins went off on, effectively, to find her liable. We argued in our brief the law, as far as rent control, is to determine who is the housing provider and who collected the illegal rent. As to transactions which do not bear specifically on that, and there's no question our clients, A, didn't exist, but didn't own any interest in the building when the rents were collected. If you're interpreting subsequent sales contracts, that is a matter for the Superior Court to decide. Now, if the tenants wanted to try to sue Cascade Inc. and LLC in Superior Court and say, we think this contract obligates the LLC to reimburse us as third-party beneficiary, something like that, they can in theory do that in court, but the rent administrator has no authority to interpret contracts in that context. All they can rent administrator can say who was a tenant's housing provider at the time of the unlawful rent collections and did that provider collect or not collect. And that, you're correct, Judge, and that's a point I think I tried to make in the brief.
Does your client still own the housing accommodations?
Yes. Yes, they do. And that's it's interesting that you mention that, because it seems that Judge Wiggins' focus was, she quite openly says, well, the tenants need to be able to collect on the judgment, but because they get a ruling in their favor doesn't mean they automatically have a right to collect against the building property. For all we know, I don't know personally, it could be totally leaned up. If a judgment is entered on a rent control matter for a rent refund, that's a personal money judgment. And you can try to collect it against bank accounts, against income received. If you get it recorded as a judgment in Superior Court, then you can try to enforce it against the property.
There's some indication in the tenant's brief that in the underlying negotiation of your client's purchase, that in some way the judgment in this case was envisioned in part of that negotiation. Do you have any information with regard to that?
No, and it wasn't. And in fact, what Judge Wiggins did, she didn't even go that far. She just took a provision out of one of the agreements and said, I'm construing this to allow the tenants the right to recover. And as we explained, and the tenants agree, A, she doesn't have the authority. That's a Superior Court matter because it's a contract. But B, it's a question of intent of creating the tenants as a third-party beneficiary. But she didn't even try to go there. She just sort of said it, more or less, without, and of course, tried to construe it without giving either Cascade Inc. or our client an opportunity to say, your construction's all wrong. And we think based on case law we've cited from the Court of Appeals, it is all wrong, because it's got to be very clear that it is intended that a third party benefit from a provision. And the language doesn't remotely create a third party beneficiary situation. And one of the points I wanted to get to specifically, and only because the tenants keep saying this is unfair to us, we've waited 16 years. Well, how is it fair to an entity that bought an interest in a building long after even the hearings in the case, evidentiary hearings case, who knew nothing about it, was given no notice, and 2007 slapped with the case, and has since spent 10 years and tens of thousands of dollars litigating to get out of a matter that it never should have been joined in to begin with? I'll say again, there's no contest to our due process argument in our brief. There was no contest to our tenancy in common argument. And you'll note, even the D.C. Court of Appeals said, because we weren't party to the leases with the tenant at the time of the sale, we're tenants in common with them. So, I pointed out, but it's somewhat serious. The position they're taking could happen to a tenant under a lease as well. Suppose a tenant comes into a residential lease, signs on, and gets stuck with the debt of a prior tenant. Based on their theory, that could happen just as well. That's just, it's not appropriate, and more importantly, there's no law that justifies it. Thank you.
Thank you. And I want to also clarify for the record, you were correct in referring to her as Ms. Wiggins. I made a mistake myself, so I apologize for that.
No, thank you.
Are we ready?
We are. Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to focus my attention on Acting Rent Administrator Grace Wiggins' 2008 decision, and specifically what she did with the tenancy in common agreement. Opposing counsel has said that she construed the contract, that she attempted to create successor liability with the contract, and as a result of that, that we are now suing as successors in liability under an intended beneficiary relationship under the contract. And that's simply not what ARA Wiggins did here. Instead, she took official notice of the sales contract while she was reviewing the caption to determine who the correct parties in this case were. And she determined that the ownership was not consistent with the registration that was on file with the Rental Housing Commission. And so she took notice of that ownership from the contract and then went on to review the contract and found that they had assumed explicit liability for all liabilities in respect to the contract.
I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Wouldn't proper enforcement of the contract call for the Cascade Park Inc. to sue Cascade Park LLC for indemnification?
Yes, assuming that we were suing as third-party beneficiaries for execution or for enforcement of the contract, yes.
So why should the LLC be added to this proceeding?
Well, Acting Rent Administrator Grace Wiggins found that the ownership of the property was held by Cascade Park Partners, LLC, at the time that the proposed order was issued, and that they had assumed that liability. That was a fact that she took into evidence when making her determination about who the appropriate parties are.
Do you think there was a mistake on her part?
I do not think it was a mistake on her part to take official notice and to acknowledge the explicit assumption of liability in the contract. Now, as to whether she should have provided appropriate notice of that official notice-taking and provided notice for the additional parties, that, as opposing counsel said, we don't contest. But after all of these appeals, Cascade Park Partners Limited is still in the position of asserting that it has no due process because it has no notice of the official notification of the sales contract and no notice of being added as a party. And they have had repeated opportunities to put forward their positions about why they shouldn't have been added as a party and why official notice should not have been taken.
Why haven't you sought enforcement in Superior Court?
We've been in the process of focusing on enforcing this appeal.
Could you sue in Superior Court if this case is reversed?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Assuming that the underlying decision and order were left undisturbed.
Okay. But the merits of the judgment aren't at issue.
Correct.
For several years.
Correct. Since the 2008 order, there's been no contest as to the underlying claims.
That's now, good. Kind of dovetailing off the question I asked the Housing Providers Council, did you ever receive, or have your clients ever received, an attached to Acting Rent Administrator Wiggins' order, contract A and B?
I was just reviewing, as you were asking, opposing counsel, and I only see A, the 95.5 sale, but not B, the 5% sale.
So in your records, you've never received this, you never had a copy of the other contract?
Of the 5% sale, no. The 95.5 sale, however, does have additional language that bears on a question that Your Honor asked regarding whether or not CPPL was aware of and contemplated these proceedings when it signed the contract. And that is on, it's paragraph K of page 7. It's titled Tenant Relations Managing, Tenant Relations and Litigation. And it says that a managing owner or agent shall have full authority to settle all, I'm paraphrasing, shall have full authority to settle all litigation pertaining to the property. It goes on to say, including but not limited to, and then asserts any litigation that occurs after the sales contract is signed. But the including and not limiting to language clearly indicates that they would also have the authority to settle litigation before the contract had occurred. And I think it's important to look at the context of the contract. These 95.5 sales were intended to circumvent TOPA protections for tenants. And as you see, they went the next year and sold the other 5%. All throughout the contract, they transfer the management and decision-making of the entire property to the 95% owner, CPPL, and that 5% owner has little, if any, interaction with the property. So the actual sale occurred in 2004, and then in 2005, the rest of the interest was transferred over.
If this gets, if we send this back, are there any issues currently that are going to come up with regard to current ownership or otherwise that's going to impact what happens in this case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Have there been subsequent sales since then? If we were to send it back, that would now kind of convolute the issue even more?
Not to my understanding, Your Honor. And so within the context of that sale and these proceedings and CPPL's repeated opportunities to put forward its position that it should not have been added, we think that it's assumption of liability in the contract, viewing the contract in its entirety, with contemplation that the managing owner, which is CPPL, had the authority to settle litigation pertaining to these proceedings, that it's reasonable to assume that they had knowledge of these proceedings, as you would in any deed of this kind, and that they could have intended and did intend to assume liability for these proceedings in negotiation of their contract.
Question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you know if Cascade Park, Inc. still exists?
It's my understanding, Your Honor, that Cascade Park, Inc. was Assurant, and I'm not actually sure if Assurant is still an entity. But
okay.
It had changed after the 2008 order, but before these proceedings.
Okay.
And so we think that they, despite the potential...
Council, wouldn't you kind of agree that there's really not much we're going to be able to do because this really gets down to interpreting a contract in order to facilitate the enforcement of a judgment which no one at this time is actually contesting, and that we're not actually the appropriate forum to be able to evaluate contract A, B, or any subsequent contractual relationships with regard to whoever is the owner, was the owner of this particular housing accommodation?
Your Honor, it's our contention that ARA Wiggins had the authority to construe the contract as facts in her record while she was in the process of issuing her final order and decision in 2008. But assuming that her procedural errors have not allowed Cascade Park Partners due process, then yes, we would ask that it be remanded so that they might be provided notice and an opportunity to be heard.
I think going back before, and I'll ask you, and then in your rebuttal, counsel, I'll ask you to respond as well. I think going back prior to Acting Rent Administrator Wiggins, there was some conversation I remember perhaps initiated by the tenants of having the matter essentially kind of transferred, for lack of a better phrase, to the OAH at that time.
That's correct.
And so, are you aware of at the time whether there was any actually statutory or regulatory provisions that would actually allow the rent administrator to specifically essentially transfer it, such that do you believe there's anything that would allow this matter to be specifically transferred or otherwise to a superior court in that same fashion this time?
And I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not aware of the specific provision. I know that at the time the request, both by CPPL and the tenants, was to transfer it to OAH for determination on this very issue of them having been added as a party.
Would that be your request now, kind of to transfer it almost in a way to Superior Court on the same issue based on kind of the same theory, and that we're left with the contractual interpretation issue as opposed to on the issue of the merits?
Assuming there was authority for that, that would be consistent with our interests.
Please continue.
So again, we believe that any procedural error that ARA Wiggins engaged in, when viewed within the context of this case and their repeated opportunities to provide their substantive arguments about why they shouldn't have been added and why the contract shouldn't have been taken notice of, are minimal. And we ask that you affirm the order of ARA Wiggins, or in the alternative, to remand the case back for an opportunity for Cascade Park Partners to have notice of the contract having been taken official notice of, and CPPL being added as a party. Thank you.
If I may proceed just briefly, a couple points. One, to make clear, the Commissioner asked, you said there appears to be no context to the judgment. If by that, if you're referring to the basic merits, absolutely. But as to our party being named to it, of course, we do contest that. Secondly, counsel has confirmed the point made at the inception of the brief, which is Ms. Wiggins, and they're joining in it, had determined that whoever owns property at the time that an order is entered, even though proceedings were taken against a prior owner who committed violations of the law, their position is who owns it now at the time of judgment, that's the person who should get stuck with the liability. He said so when he said, Ms. Wiggins stated that she found that ownership was not consistent with who the landlord is. She was talking about ownership in 2007 when she entered her decision, not in terms of who it was that they actually named as a housing provider and had the hearings against. And obviously, that's not a valid rule of law. council gets to, and I think this is probably what had Ms. Wiggins going, there was a TOPA, 95-5. She may not have liked it. It was lawful, and to the best of my knowledge, it was never challenged. It happened. There was no challenge brought by the tenants to it. It was what it was at the time. And finally, in response, and with regard to that point about the ownership not being consistent with the land record, the tenants themselves said, we filed two motions, 2005 and 2006, to name Cascade Inc. as a respondent, not the LLC. It was Ms. Wiggins, sui sponte, who went over to land record and said, hey, the LLC owns it now, I'm going to name them. So if they thought there was an inconsistency that should be changed, why didn't they file the motion? Now, maybe they moved, maybe they didn't. I don't know what was done at the time. What I do know is Ms. Wiggins took it upon herself or was told by somebody, hey, there's a 95-5 agreement. Cascade Inc. doesn't own it anymore. There's a different owner. These are the people who you should enter the judgment against. Or she decided on herself. And that is just the gross abuse of due process and everything else is mind-boggling. Finally, this case has been remanded once. And the commissioner who remanded said in a footnote, we recognize the LLC's probably on the next appeal going to raise the same arguments they did here. He had sympathy to that. He said, out of abundance of protecting everybody, we're going to direct the rent administrator to reissue the order so that we could appeal it. So we have challenged this from 2008 on, and that's why we're here this time, to continue the challenge we started back then and finally get what should be done.
So you would like a full hearing below?
Absolutely not. As a matter of law, we shouldn't have been added. If we'd been given notice back then, it would have been illegal because we were a tenant in common and we weren't the housing provider under the Act who collected the unlawful rent. No evidence was offered or suggested that we were a successor to Cascade Inc. And successor means successor corporation. We were a tenant in common. We purchased a property, but as the law we've cited shows, that does not make one a successor. There's no privity there.
All right. Well, thanks to both parties, both sides, for putting on a really good case here. The commission's hearing is now completed. The commission will issue its decision to the parties within 30 to 45 days. It is now 11:39. This hearing is adjourned. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.